it's not code per se that scares people. It's that they don't know what they want to build. They don't know the future. They don't know how to deconstruct the app in a way that makes sense to the prompting and to the AI. If you're a designer who never touched components, of course you're gonna have a hard time. But if you're a designer who has created design systems and components and variables, I don't believe for a second you're gonna have trouble learning code, because it's the same concept. Most importantly, this is the most important part. It has to shake your core to a point where you're not gonna give up, and use that feeling, use that emotion to create your first artifact in Claude. If you do that, then I think code is not that scary.
Welcome to Dive Club. My name is Rid, and this is where designers never stop learning. Now, if you've been listening to this show for a little bit, you know that a big theme is talking about what it looks like to transition from being a traditional designer to more of a builder and taking advantage of all of this new technology that we have available to us. So when I saw Meng tweet about his process building a fully fledged video editing product in 3 months, I knew that I had to have him onto the show to get the complete backstory. If you're not familiar, Meng has spent years teaching designers how to code, so he's the perfect person to walk us through how our tools are evolving and what it all means for designers.
I've been designing and coding for the past 20 or so years, and I have this platform called Design Code, which I started about 10 years ago. I started with blocks. I think most designers and developers, they start with blocks. They notice a little bit of a spike in the traffic, and eventually, when you get enough people who enjoy your writing or your content, then you start thinking about, you know, something like a platform or a course. And then that's kind of like what Design Code was. So back in the day, there were not a lot of them. I remember there were a couple of developers that I followed, like Nathan Berry and the founder of Sidebar. They start their own course. I was really curious about that. And eventually I decided, okay, let's do it. So the way that I did it was I started a website. The book was not even finished, but I wanted to see if people wanted to kind of like learn from that content. So I launched it with a pre-order, and next thing you know, this is what started the platform. This is what started the whole Design Code.
I have a smile on my face just listening to you talk, because you know, you were such a big part of my own journey. Like 5 years ago, when I was deciding, yeah, like I want to make a course, I want to get into design education, who do I look at for inspiration? And I was like studying everything that you're doing. And so to hear that story and the arc and get to know the person behind the brand a little bit is a special moment for me.
Really honored to be here and to do this podcast with you.
Real quick message, and then we can jump back into it. So I've been using this new product to do research called Genway. It uses AI-powered interviewers to help you gather qualitative data at basically an infinite scale. So I've actually been interviewing listeners of this show all over the world. I tell the AI what I'm hoping to learn, and then it has a dynamic conversation with each person. Genway then organizes all of the key insights for me automatically. So I learned more in a 2-week study than I had in a year and a half prior. Needless to say, I am totally hooked. And if you want to take your research to the next level, head to dive.club/Genway to get 2 months free. That's Genway. I've been anticipating today for quite some time because Raycast Notes are finally here. Their old floating notes product was my go-to for quick captures, but they've truly taken it to the next level. There's markdown for formatting, keyboard shortcuts, multiple notes. You can even create a quick link to a specific note and assign a hotkey to it. So that way you can quickly open it up from anywhere in a single keystroke. It's just another way that Raycast helps me stay in flow while I work. So if you're not using it already, seriously, I can't recommend this product enough. Head to dive.club/Raycast to get started. That's R-A-Y-C-A-S-T. Okay, now onto the episode. So I want to take advantage of your perspective as someone who really understands both the design and the code side. And you've maintained that vantage point for, you know, quite some time now. And all of a sudden, you know, AI is on the horizon. Everything's changing. We're all kind of looking forward into the future, wondering what if. And I want to get into some of that, but maybe even to start, you could even give a little bit of background and context as to what you see as today's landscape. How would you describe the state of AI as a design tool today?
I have a pretty hot take about AI. I think AI is still pretty much like a big hit or miss. And it is a big miss if you don't understand the idea of not giving up. It's very, very easy to do something bad with AI. It's very easy to do something like a design or a photo or an image or something, or even code. But if you get past that, AI becomes really, really powerful. And you have to kind of use the strengths of AI. And right now, there are a few key areas in which AI does really, really well. The first one is writing, right? So everyone uses AI for writing. It's especially wonderful because people know how to use AI. Now, how many people use AI for design? Maybe not a lot. How many people use AI for coding? That's an increasing amount, because AI for coding is extremely powerful, because this is a medium, this is a platform that typically is very, very difficult to jump into, especially for designers. What is really, really hot right now is using Cursor with Claude. And this is extremely recent. I think it was like 5 months ago, or even less. I think 4 months ago that people really started using Claude. And Claude was, for me, a big moment, because I didn't realize how coding could be so powerful. Of course, we all knew, you know, GitHub Copilot. It's really good for auto-completions, but auto-completions doesn't create apps, right? I think Claude, what Claude did at that time was to convince us with artifacts that you can essentially build apps, you can build ideas, and you can have something that you've always wanted to solve, either as a prototype, as a design, and turn that into an artifact. And that was the first step into AI using from coding. When I realized that, I was experimenting with creating, like, you know, okay, let's create something that looks like a Figma plugin. I think everyone starts with that, right? Like, you open Figma, you're like, okay, how can I improve Figma? There's a lot of stuff that Figma doesn't do, whether it's animations, whether it's like just solving small problems like selecting layers or renaming layers and stuff like that. Well, you can essentially open Claude and just prompt and ask Claude, okay, can you make a small tool that solves exactly that problem? So that's what was my first kind of venture into AI as a tool builder. And I did that with an SVG pattern. And I thought, wow, this is really cool. I can just like creating a bunch of, you know, like SVGs and patterns and put it together and create a background. And then eventually I got it to animate, and that was like a small little tool. I spent about 3 weeks on it, and then I launched it with payments and all that stuff. And that's when I realized, okay, well, this is really powerful, because regardless of the design tool, you will always hit a wall, because the design tools are always limited by the boundaries of what you can do within that design tool. Even the really powerful one like Figma, a lot of designers choose not to learn coding, that's fine. But for those who really want to stop kind of depending on developers, oh, you know, can you move some pixels? Can you build this function for me? So what AI enables us to do now, you can essentially learn step by step using AI, ask the right questions, not giving up, and then take that artifact feature by feature, line by line, learning incrementally how to read and scan the code, how to customize the UI, and then finally build something as complex as DreamCut. And I think that's kind of like what's really, really exciting about AI right now.
Okay, so I have a million questions about the journey to build something as complex as DreamCut. And maybe before we start to get into it, can you just give us like a little bit of context? Like, why was this the product that you were excited to invest in and figure out how to make it?
So when you build a product with AI, it's really important to not forget your dreams. Like, what do you want to do? Like, what do you want to solve? I think a lot of people especially right now, I open Twitter and I see a lot of people, how to build this app to do app in 5 minutes. Who cares? No, right? Like, yes, it's fun. Yes, you might learn code along the way. However, what is even more meaningful is if you can build something that actually solves a problem, a market fit in this industry. And not just any market fit, your market fit, who you are and what do you use on a daily basis. If you can do that, then I think AI can be really powerful. And I think you can really stand out from a market that will soon be saturated by so many of these 5 minute apps, right? So DreamCut is kind of like that second phase of my journey, right? Like the first one was creating a small app with SVG, you know, that could be like a Figma plugin or its own web app. The second phase was, okay, so right now I have to think about what do I use on a daily basis, right? So one tool that I use a lot is Screen Studio. I think a lot of designers are using that nowadays to record your screen, and you want to showcase what you're building, what you're designing, what you're animating. And it's a really, really good tool. I love that tool. But really quickly, as a designer who teach, you realize the limitations of Screen Studio because it's not made to be a long video. It's not made to have multiple clips. So I thought, okay, I'm using Screen Studio. I'm using CapCut to put all of these Screen Studio segments together. Everything is on my hard drive. If I want to collaborate with people, I cannot do that. And then I also use ChatGPT, right, to do the ideation, ask questions, scripting, and all that stuff. We also use 11 Labs to do the AI voice. Not everyone is fluent with English, right? So we use 11 Labs, which is the most natural sounding AI platform for creating and generating voices. So the idea was that I have all of these tools and I really want to make a tool that does all of that stuff in one single product. I know it sounds really ambitious and it is, but you never go into a product thinking that, oh, it's too ambitious. Oh, it's too difficult to do. You always go into a product by being very optimistic. And you go into a product by solving problems one by one. I want to start with a small, simple problem, which is a screen recording multiple clips and having sort of like a working web editor.
I want to drill into those like early first steps, initial explorations, because something that I saw is you said that you just skipped Figma altogether. So can you talk a little bit about why? And then also like how did that impact your ability to shape and figure out what the product can even be in the early days?
I'm sure you can relate to this, a lot of designers. You design something and then you realize after a few days, a few hours, a few weeks, that's impossible to do. And that is a huge time waster. The last thing you want to happen during the creation process of a product is just making really wrong assumptions. And especially because you're building a complex product. You're building something that is extremely experimental. You're doing AI stuff, right? AI is by nature very experimental. Like I went into the video editor, I'm like, can I even create a video editor? So what is the point of designing in Figma if I don't even know if that's even possible? So that's exactly why I skipped Figma. Now that's the first part. The second part is Claude is really good at designing, not in the sense of what most designers think. Most designers think design is all about beautiful pixels and styles. That's not what design is all about. In fact, design is about function, right? It's about problem solving. And if you think about design that way, Claude is really, really good at that. So you can say, okay, build a simple video player. It's going to do that video player for you. It's going to design the basic foundation of it. And, you know, it might not have the perfect, you know, glass buttons with like animations and stuff like that. But that's where you come in as a designer, right? Like if you think that design is aesthetics, then please be that person to correct AI. But design as a foundation, as a problem-solving tool, as a function, AI is capable of doing that very, very well. And that's exactly why you can absolutely skip Figma. Because, you know, let's say I want to build a timeline. Okay, create a timeline. I want to have multiple clips. You know, I want to be able to drag and drop all that stuff. AI can do that. It's not going to look perfect. It might even make mistakes. But at the very least, you can continue. You can continue that conversation going. And you have to think of AI more like a technical co-founder, more like a collaborator, like maybe like a developer who sits next to you. If you think of AI that way, then you can continue that conversation. It's not like a one-time prompt. It's like most people think, oh, you know, let's create the perfect prompt. It's going to have like, you know, 500 characters and I'm going to describe everything and AI is just going to create the perfect tool for me. That has been so far from my experience. My experience is like, I like very simple prompt. My best prompts are probably like 2 or 3 sentences. And then I'm like, I'm curious. I'm really, really curious to see what AI is going to create. Like sometimes I just want to hit that enter button. Like I want to see what this technical co-founder is going to create for me. If you think of design as more like letting someone building the foundation and kind of like confirming what is possible and what is not possible, and you kind of like moving the pixels, eventually you're styling. You know, like I think a lot of designers can relate to that. You know, they would say, okay, can you build me that? You can ask the developer, can you build this? And then the developer comes back and they're like, oh, this is what I have so far. And then you're like, oh, let me get into the code and fix the styles. You know, like it's a collaboration.
Totally.
And it's fun.
Can we look at just like those first 10 or so prompts? Like I think a lot of designers like, this sounds really cool. They open up Claude Artifacts and it's unclear, like, what level of specificity do you even start at? Like, do you say, build me a video editing product? Or do you say, build me a sidebar with this functionality and then a timeline down here? Like, how did you think about going from 0 to 1 with those first 10 or so prompts? And do you have any advice for people who truly are staring at the blank canvas, have never done this before, and they're trying to figure out what to put in that text box?
This is a really important question. If you're someone who can really describe what you want in words, you can do really well with building products using AI. Now, I'm not gonna sugarcoat it. I know a lot of designers who have a hard time communicating in their ideas. And this could be a good playground for those people. AI and building is all about the specificity, the context, and sort of like getting to know what you want and what features that you want. Because it's like, I definitely don't recommend saying, I want to build a video editor. It's too vague. It's too broad. It's like saying, I want to build a car. I want to build an electric car. It's not going to get you anywhere because there's so much going on inside a car. And I really like what Elon Musk says when he build product. He's like, And especially when he learns, he said, go back to the first principles. And I think that's such a powerful idea, right? Like if you want to build a battery, you shouldn't say, I want to build a battery that is more efficient. You should just say, you just go to the first principle and kind of look at the ingredients of the battery, you know, like, oh, you know, lithium and all that stuff. And if you do that with building a video editor, you should not say, I want to build a video editor. I want to build a flying car. You should more like say, okay, what is the composition of video editor? Okay, so we have the timeline, we have the video player, we have some of the features like drag and drop, we have, you know, screen recording, maybe. We want to be able to have an inspector so that we can edit. So again, those are really good keywords to have. And the next question is like, where do you want to start, right? And don't start too ambitious, right? You shouldn't say, I want to have, you know, all of these things and it has to work perfectly. Depending on the complexity of what you're asking, it's definitely not going to get there on the first go. And so the way I would do it is like, can you build a video editor? Don't stop there. With a video player that has a play and stop button. And then with that, I want to have a timeline where I can have a clip And then you have to sort of like think about, okay, what is that clip? You know, where is that file coming from? What is that clip, right? Where is it coming from? And then you can specify, okay, I want the URL to be from a YouTube video. Or you can say, I want to be able to upload that video, right? So that would be the first prompt. I want to build a video editor with a timeline, with a video player, and I want to be able to upload the video. And so try to make it work, right? And then from there, you have a pretty good foundation of where to start. And then, you know, you're going to see what AI gives you. And from there, it's a lot about correction. It's a lot about, you know, okay, so actually, I don't want a URL to be entering. Or, you know, sometimes it just gives you bugs, you know, I cannot upload the video. It doesn't work. Or sometimes it's like, works perfectly. That's amazing. Then you go to the next step. You're like, okay, so now I want to have multiple videos. Now I want to be able to drag and drop the timeline. Oh, now I want to have an audio timeline. I want to have a text timeline. And then I want to frame my video, right? I want to frame it in the middle. I want to have a background. Oh, I want to have a gradient. I want to have colors. I want to be able to customize the colors. I want to be able to have a video background that plays. I want to be able to zoom. So those are kind of like the first, you know, 10 prompts.
I really like the idea of deconstructing the battery and thinking about the individual components versus having these just like higher level descriptions, basically. And I'm kind of wondering now, like, how far did you go before you started intentionally worrying about the aesthetic of the product? And then what does it take to effectively push past that more generic output that Claude's going to give you by default?
So I'm going to tell you a secret that most designers do at the stage at which they want to start thinking about aesthetics. That stage is exactly the same time when they want to tweet. That's the secret. The secret is to hold yourself accountable and to ship something that you are proud of. I don't think about aesthetics until I get to that stage. And sometimes it can take an hour. Sometimes it can take a day. Sometimes it can take even a week. You can sort of like 2x, 3x, 5x the impact of that product by just adding that 20%, 10% of work at the end by using the right tool, the right kit, the right approach, the right prompts, right? Sometimes it's about learning Tailwind, for example. Just learning Tailwind can give you a huge leg up in terms of understanding aesthetics, you know, like, oh, I want to understand the colors, you know, the color spectrum of Tailwind, like how, because AI tends to use Tailwind. Why is it use Tailwind? It's because it's the most all-in-one file way of creating an artifact. You don't need to have like a CSS file on top of it. And it's not as technical as having inline JavaScript. So Tailwind is the perfect tool for that. You can also browse Google and you're like, okay, give me some UI kit using Tailwind. Let me copy the code, paste that code into Claude AI and say, I want the style to look exactly like this, right? Even if you Google and you paste the code from the UI kit, it's still going to make mistakes. Sometimes it's going to use the wrong colors. Sometimes it's going to use the wrong adaptiveness. So you get into the code, you incrementally learn about the code and Tailwind. That's how you get into the sort of like super high detail.
Can we go a little bit deeper into that like final 5% of visual detail? Because like even like on the website with some of these cards, I mean, like really, really beautiful hover states. You have gradient borders, like some like subtle inner shadows. Like there's a lot of visual detail that's going into that. How much of that is being fine-tuned with natural language versus maybe you're getting in there and writing the Tailwind? How cumbersome is it to even deal with something like Claude when you're trying to write code that is like super, super, super visual?
So the way that I think about code and the same way I think about Figma is I love to create components. I don't love to create components in a sense that just to make my team happy. I don't care about that, right? They will be happy if the product is good. What I care about is the idea that I can reuse something that I have created in my past. The main reason why I create UI kits is because I want to sort of like go through that experience and sort of like memorize that in a way that I can reuse it in the future. So when you talk about the cards and when you talk about the lights and you talk about the outline gradient, that's because I have done that in the past. And all I needed to do was to take that component code and give it to Claude and say, I want that applied to this component. If you can do that, then your experience become richer and richer over time. All the code that you have created and the product that you're making, even if your product ends up in a failure, you have gained hundreds, thousands of components and techniques that you can reuse for your next product. And so if you think about it this way, it's the same for building a product with AI. You cannot think of it as sort of like, I'm going to start everything from scratch. So for example, the gradient that I did, that was part of the course that I did, an experimentation that I did before using GPT-4. I just went back to that tutorial that I did, copy some of the code, and I'm like, okay, turn this code into React component, make it reusable, and then in one line of code, I want you to apply this to this component. And in the end, it was just replacing a div and put that into a component instead. So right now, if you use React, oftentimes, if you start from scratch, it's going to be a div. But eventually, you're going to create hooks. You're going to create components. So that's going to turn into a component. You're going to pass props, so properties and customizations. And highly recommended because, you know, yes, it's nice to have an artifact. The artifact is going to just cram all the code together and it's just going to look like a huge spaghetti of code. Eventually, you're going to have to say, look, turn this, you know, animation into a component, turn this function into a hook, turn this style into a reusable style. So if you do that, then it's pretty easy to apply a lot of the stuff that you have done in the past. So, you know, the cards, the animations. And the other thing is that even if it doesn't exist that you haven't done in the past, you do it sometimes by mistake, sometimes by happy accidents. Sometimes you know, Claude just have a good day, you know, have a good prompt. and then you encapsulate it into something that you can reuse in the future. And so, for example, all the animation that you see, the sequence animation that you see in the whole landing page, is just one line of code that I keep reusing all the time. And that one line is just an animation that a CSS style that I added on top of Tailwind. And is basically like a keyframe, blur up, blur down. And then I just figure out a way to just have a single line of code that I add to a div. And it's in an inline CSS, which is fine. But I love to be able to just copy that one line and just apply it and just customize the index value or the delay value. And so that's how you can get those, you know, like word by word sequence animation that blurs. You know, Apple does that a lot nowadays. But not just word, but you can also do like character by character. So the logo animation, I did that exactly. And if you have that context, back to the code prompting, if you have that context, that piece of code that you include in the prompt, the description on how you use it and the way you use it, and you give that to Claude, it's going to adapt everything for you. And it's really, really cool.
So I think there's probably someone listening right now who's very AI curious that doesn't have the coding background. And, you know, they were following along and they were feeling pretty good about themselves. And then you started dropping things like props and hooks and when to abstract something out into a component. And it started to get a little bit scarier. So maybe my question is, you know, as someone who has spent a lot of time teaching designers how to code and vice versa, how far has AI pushed the barrier to entry? Like, what is essentially the bare minimum understanding of code that someone has to have in order to build a product even remotely close to something like DreamCut? Because I would assume that, you know, if you don't know anything, you're probably going to have a little bit of a difficult time. Where is that new line, that new technical threshold for designers?
Here's the deal. You should always think of code the same way you think about design. It's not necessarily more difficult than design. In fact, a lot of the things that you do in Figma right now is actually more complex than what you would do in code. It's actually easier to code than to design for a lot of things. The only problem and that's the sort of like the bad PR that code has, is that it can get really, really, really far. But if you go back to first principle, if you think about components, the same thing as in Figma. If you think about adaptive layout in CSS, it's the same in Figma. So design tools have become so sophisticated nowadays that it's not, I don't even think that it's easier to do the same things in Figma. In fact, to create something functional, it's actually harder to create in Figma than it is to create in Claude. So yes, it can get technical, but don't give up. First of all, the same way that I started with Dreamcut, I didn't start with Dreamcut directly. I started with the SVG, tool. And even before that, you can probably just create like a simple portfolio, or you can just learn components in Figma. You can just learn prototyping in Figma, right? Like, you have to think of like small jumps. You have to think about using segues into something more complex. And most importantly, this is the most important part. It has to shake your core to a point where you're not going to give up when you're going to get there. So for example, you create a prototype in Figma and you're going to be like, I wish to my core that I can make this form functional. And I wish I can just submit it to a real database. When you get to that phase where you have a problem in front of you that you cannot solve by something that is not code, then that's a perfect segue to learn code. And use that feeling, use that emotion to create your first artifact in Claude. If you do that, then I think code is not that scary. You should never compare yourself to someone or to a product that is finished. You have to keep in mind that a lot of these products take years to complete. In my case, it took me 3 months to get there. And if you think about the result in those 3 months, you're not going to get there in one go, in one prompt.
It reminds me of something that Mariana Castillo said a few episodes ago. She talked about like how the first couple times she failed learning how to code was because she was learning for the sake of learning. But it was only the third time where she's like, you know what? I'm actually just going to build a thing that I care about and solve some kind of like a problem. And that was what got her to the point where she would keep going and push through, and then just at every stage take the accumulation of all the knowledge that she had and just solve the next problem. And it's like really interesting to see that parallel where, yeah, when you're diving into some of the meatier parts of this product, it would have been very easy to just kind of hit pause on that set of tutorial videos. But when you're building something you care about, it's totally different.
Absolutely. You know, I love to build stuff that I can release. And that's the other part, right? Like you have to hold yourself accountable, you know, like it's like deadlines, you know, like if you build a product without deadlines, you know, there's going to be a lot of people who's going to take forever to do something. But as soon as you set a deadline, you know, suddenly you have the motivation to do it. And the same with building in public, right? Like if you build a product in public, you hold yourself accountable and you're not going to release something that you're not proud of, that you don't think that it's surprising or fun or cool or, you know, or something that is new. So if you build in public, I think that's also going to be another element that's going to help you learn code. And, you know, don't be shy, be shameless, not in a tactless way, but be shameless in a powerful way, in a way that if you fail, it's fine because you're building the skills, you're building the knowledge, and you're also connecting with people who are failing like you. Not failing in a bad way, failing in a sense that you're experimenting and it might not get to from point A to point Z, but it might get you to point two, to point B, you know, point C. And that's totally fine. People connect with that. People love that story. And so that's the power of building in public. In fact, I would say 100% of my product would fail without me building in public. So yes, you know, like do it. Just share your findings. And if you find that something is cool, most likely other people would find it cool as well.
Hey, it's Rid. I'm constantly asked about my favorite products, so I'm gonna take just 1 minute and give you a quick rundown of my stack. Desyn is how I ship design changes without having to code. Framer is how I build my websites. Genway is how I do research. Jitter is how I animate my designs. And Play is how I design and prototype mobile apps. Visual Electric is how I generate all of my imagery, and Raycast is my shortcut every step of the way. Now, I've hand-selected these companies to partner with me so that I can do these episodes full-time. So the best way by far to support the show is to check them out. You can find the full list at dive.club/partners. Okay, now on to the rest of the episode. A lot of times when designers even imagine building something substantial with AI, it's just intimidation and getting yourself psyched up to, like, you know, tackle it and dive in all the way. But on the flip side, were there elements of this project that maybe were easier than you thought, or were, like, surprisingly more straightforward when having AI as a collaborator?
There's a lot of things that are obviously easier when you start doing it. Just giving an example, yesterday I started working on a camera recording because, you know, I launched DreamCut without being able to record the camera. And honestly, before starting the camera, I thought this is going to be a really big feature. That's why I kind of hold it off. But then I started doing it and I started prompting, and I'm going to walk you through the prompt. So
please,
you know, you have to look at the origin of the experience, right? Where does the experience start? So for the camera feature, recording your camera, like here, it starts with the screen recording modal. It's a modal where you kind of like enable the camera, the microphone, and the window that you want to record. And that's exactly where I started. I opened that file. I'm in Cursor. I'm like, okay, so I want to be able to record the camera. That's it, right? You know, like, because I have so much context in the file already.
Yeah.
I didn't need to say so much more. Yeah, I didn't need to say so much more because it already has all the context in my file. And that's the beauty of already starting something previously, is that if you already have the window recording, the microphone recording, AI has a pretty good idea already of how to tackle this problem. And so I was like typing, I want to be able to, you know, to record my face, you know, using a camera in a browser and all that stuff. And I was like trying to think, okay, what else do I need to say? And I tap enter, boom, you know, like, that's it. It works, you know, like, yeah, it just worked. It knew exactly what to do. It knew all the context. And next thing you know, I was just like, you know, obviously there was a permission thing. So, you know, I think that there was just a little follow-up prompt. Make sure to ask for permission to allow for the camera to work. And then I did that, and then boom, I saw the camera, and it was like really straightforward. And from there, from the modal, I had to think about how it affects the rest. So I was like, okay, so the modal does the recording, and once the recording completes, it has to save the file in the cloud, first of all. Second of all, it has to save it into a state, and the state has to translate into the canvas. So the canvas is sort of like the player. And then you go back to the master file, which is kind of like the main file that connects all the files together. And this is where you're saying, okay, so I want to store that into a state. I want to upload that to the cloud. I want to connect that to the canvas so I can show the camera. And then finally, I want to save the file in the cloud with all the states and synchronize everything. And then the last part was to export with all of those new changes. And so that's how I went about that feature, and it was surprisingly easy. I did that in like half a day, which is crazy.
It's amazing.
You know,
yeah,
like,
mind-blowing. It's interesting to hear you talk too, because like, just the way that you're breaking down the flow into like these very concrete steps, like at an atomic level, what needs to happen at each step in order to make this work. That way of thinking definitely exists outside of code. I think designers can think like that even when they're in Figma. Like, that is the best representation of what it looks like to actually think like an engineer while designing that I think anyone's actually had on this show before.
I absolutely agree. Like, you're a designer. You shouldn't think that you're so different from engineers. The only difference between a designer and the engineer is just a tool. It's yeah. just because one is more specialized in one tool and the other one is more specialized in another tool. In fact, a lot of the best engineers that I follow on Twitter are amazing designers. They can create beautiful apps, even more beautiful apps than I can create. And, you know, think about ShatCN, for example. It's one person who does design and code really, really well. And yeah, these are the kinds of people that I follow on Twitter. And designers are not very different from engineers. It's just that instead of coding, designers, they create the components in Figma. And, you know, instead of always focusing on statics, developers, they also think about the backend and the data. Sometimes designers don't think about those, but I do argue that the best designers that I know think about data. They think about experience. They think about what is feasible, what is not feasible. They think about constraints. They think about adaptiveness. They think about layouts and how that translates to code. It's an evolution, right? You don't start, you know, at step 100, but you definitely start at level one. And then eventually you learn about auto layout, and eventually you learn about, you know, design systems, and you learn about constraints. You learn about browser compatibilities, right? You learn about, oh, I can do this with a mobile phone. Oh, I cannot do this with a desktop. Those are all the skills that translate really, really well to code.
It's kind of a perfect segue for the next question I wanted to ask you, which is, yeah, for someone that just wants to get started by building a Figma plugin or maybe a portfolio site, like, you're still kind of operating in this front end, you know, tailwind kind of world. But man, when you get up to 50,000 lines of code, like, you're making real architectural design decisions then, and you're thinking a lot more about data layer, how to organize the project, and what different services to use. There's a lot to figure out in that bucket. So can you talk to us a little bit about how did you approach that process, and what were some of the challenges that you had to overcome along the way?
So again, have you ever done a design system? That's a massive endeavor. And you have to think about the data layers, the components, the properties, all the states and all that stuff. It's super complex. And then you have to think about the variables now, because, like, you know, Figma has variables and you have to work with developers. That's not much different from how I deal with creating, a product that has 50,000 lines of code. The only problem that it can get hectic, especially for someone who's doing a little bit more backend, is it's a little bit more abstract, but the rest, the front end, especially as a designer, and you can build really, really amazing products on the front end, by the way. And security is something that, honestly, it is important, of course, at launch, when you're ready to deal with paying customers and all that stuff. But when you're prototyping, when you're building an MVP, when you're building something that is meant to be shipped as quickly as possible, you can deal with some of the security, I'm not saying all, and I'm not saying none, but some of that a little bit later. Sometimes I work with backend engineers and work with engineers. I ask for a simple product or a simple feature, and they come up with a nuclear solution, you know, like, they come up with these crazy plans, and that's just overkill. So that's the flip side of engineering. So I like to strike a good balance of working the same way that you Figma. Yeah, I use Figma as a verb.
I was going to call it out. That needs to catch on. I can't believe I haven't used Figma as a verb. And even listening to you talk, I think it's also important to call out the fact that, like, I mean, not everyone listening is going to just, like, embark on this 3-month journey to build this incredible product. Like, a fantastic starting spot is what you were describing, where it's like, man, I just wish I could do this thing in a Figma prototype, but I can't. Let's use Claude to just, like, whip up a quick prototype. And maybe you have dedicated back engineers. Maybe you're working on a team where it really is more of a front end constrained tool. And even in that world, it's incredibly powerful. And maybe even just to give everyone, like, kind of the full picture context, can you just give a quick rundown of, like, what are the different tools that you're using and what are they for? When are you even in artifacts versus just cursor is one specific question I have on that topic.
The way that I think about it is that you should start as simple as possible. And that first step should be artifact or V0 or, you know, GitHub just announced Spark, or, you know, there's also Bolt.new. So to me, I think that this is the new generation of design tools, the design tools that create a design and turn into code right away. And it's really powerful because it can be functional, it can prototype, it can solve all of these problems that design tools, most of them cannot do right now. Or at least, even if they do, they're going to hide the code from you, or, you know, you're kind of like stuck in sort of like a subscription thing. So I think you should start with these design tools. You should start with just ideation and just explore what's possible. Claude is a good starting point to see what is possible and laying out the foundation without the aesthetics, or at least with a very, very generic style. And then Shatsien, if you're kind of like want to be a little bit more beautiful, but again, not super unique. And then when you get past a certain amount of coding lines, so I think the key is like 400 lines of code. When you get past 400 lines of code, then it's time to move to Cursor. Cursor, it's really scary. But you learn it once, right? You learn it once, just the same way you learn Figma once, and the next time, you're good. So you set up Cursor. Cursor, essentially, you export the file. You can even download the React file. And then you can just install all the stuff like Node and stuff like that. That is the scariest part of coding, to be honest. Because you have to install all of these libraries, you have to start the server, the local environment. But once you're done, then you can essentially bring your code, copy and paste or download, and then you run your app in a single page. And this is really popular nowadays. It's like having a single page deal with everything and have everything. The single page app or a single page landing page, those are really fantastic starting points. And so you go into Cursor, you create your single file application, and then you get as far as possible. But eventually, you're going to hit maybe 1,000 lines of code, and that's time to split. So we call that code splitting, and that's when you create components. Again, everything I mentioned, yes, there are terms about React, but I can say the same thing about Figma. As soon as you have 100 layers, it's time to create components. The same thing with code. So as soon as you have 1,000 lines of code, you create components and hooks, and you want to reuse it. So you have a header or footer, so you have to create a component to reuse it. You have multiple models of AI that you can use. So right now I use Claude, and Claude is really good. But one thing that I do need to mention is that sometimes some of these models can be biased, but also can generate the same answer over and over, which is fine. Which is sometimes it's good to switch to a different model. Sometimes I like to switch to the O1 preview or the O1 mini just to have a different perspective and to see how it can solve the same problem. The other thing I would say is that go directly to Cursor Composer. So Cursor Composer allows you to let AI do the changes of the code for you and create the files for you. So that's a lot less scary. In fact, my son, who's 8 years old, was able to use, you know, Composer and was able to create apps without touching a single line of code. And that's, you know, if someone who's 8 years old, who has no knowledge of code, who, of course, is more like a product designer because he's a monster, by the way. Like, I see him build stuff every day. He used this application called Scratch. Scratch is the equivalent of visual programming for kids. Essentially, you can drag and drop functions and values, and it creates, like, a programming of a game or of a page or something like that. And he creates like one project a day. It's insane. He's so fast. He has built hundreds of Scratch projects over the past year. That's how he builds that sort of like creative mindset, that designer coder mindset, that regardless of the tool that you're doing, whether it's code or Figma or Scratch, you know what you want and you know how to build it. So my argument is it's not code per se that scares people. It's that they don't know what they want to build. They don't know the feature. They don't know how to deconstruct the app in a way that makes sense to the prompting and to the AI. If you're a designer who never touched components, of course you're going to have a hard time working with AI and coding. But if you're a designer who has created design systems, landing pages and components and variables, I don't believe for a second you're going to have trouble learning code, because it's the same concept. You know, it's the same with my 8 years old son who's able to do code by just asking AI to do all the work for him.
Well, you kind of read my mind bringing up your son. That was like the little note that I had too, where I was just like, you know what? If you're listening to this and it's intimidating, Meng's 8 year old kid did it. You probably can too. So Meng, thanks for coming on. I mean, this was just like ridiculously practical. Thanks for pulling back the curtain, showing just how you're thinking about this, all the different prompts that you're doing. Like, there's just so much in this. I hope that people listening are inspired to take that first step. It's a beautiful era to be a designer that builds. So thanks for coming on and talking to us about it today.
Well, first of all, I love that you're creating this kind of podcast and share the stories from creators, and especially people that are making apps nowadays using AI. I think it's extremely relevant to the market. But not just that, I think it's important to demystify a lot of things that are happening right now with AI. And, you know, a lot of people don't use AI. I think they're missing out. I'm sure they have really good reasons, but at the same time, I think AI is a multiplier, right? Like, if you don't use AI, I think you're going to be highly disadvantaged. And what is cool about AI is that everyone can use AI anywhere in the world, any level of education, and it's here to fill the gap. So it starts with writing. It goes, you know, with coding, but eventually it's going to get into design and all that stuff. I really look forward to that. I'm really happy that you're covering this kind of topic, and I love what you're creating. So thank you so much. I'm really honored to be part of this podcast.
Hey, it's Rid. Don't forget, if you want to go even deeper, each week I send an email out to over 10,000 designers with bonus resources and key takeaways from these conversations. So head to dive.club/email to sign up. Okay, I'll see you next week.